you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
KPCC supporters include Searchlight Pictures presenting Jojo Rabbit, nominated for 6 Academy Awards, supporting actress Scarlett Johansson, adapted screenplay by Taika Waititi, film editing, production design, costume design, and best picture of the year.
And 20th Century Fox presenting Ford vs. Ferrari, directed by James Mangold and starring Matt Damon and Christian Bale. Ford vs. Ferrari is now nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture of the Year.
From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for John Horn. On today's show, Glenn Keane, the animator who shared an Academy Award with Kobe Bryant for the animated short film Dear Basketball.
And so we went shot by shot through Kobe's 20 greatest plays, and he remembered every moment and described that moment, why he was able to do that shot, what was his intention.
Then filmmaker Carlos Lopez Estrada talks about collaborating with 24 LA spoken word artists for his movie Summertime. And the Oscar-nominated production designer from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood leads a tour of the film's locations. It's The Frame. We'll be right back.
KPCC supporters include Searchlight Pictures presenting Jojo Rabbit, nominated for 6 Academy Awards, supporting actress Scarlett Johansson, adapted screenplay by Taika Waititi, film editing, production design, costume design, and best picture of the year. Now playing in theaters nationwide.
When Kobe Bryant retired in 2016, he penned a farewell letter to the game that he called Dear Basketball. It was later turned into an animated short film by veteran animator Glenn Keane with music by John Williams, the composer for Star Wars and other classic films.
This season is all I have left to give. My heart can take the pounding. My mind can handle the grind. But my body knows it's time to say goodbye.
Dear Basketball won an Academy Award in 2018. Keane is a former Disney animator. He had never met Kobe prior to the making of Dear Basketball, and he told me about that nervous first meeting when Kobe and his family visited his animation studio.
That day, he showed up with Vanessa and the girls, and we brought him in, and there was this moment of, like, what's Kobe going to think of this tiny little studio? It was in a little duplex, and I mean, it wasn't like the big fancy studios. And you looked around and saw the sketches on the wall. And, you know, for a moment I thought, oh, I know he's got to be disappointed. And, and he said, it's perfect.
Yeah. The recording of Kobe's monologue, his read comes off as very intimate. What conversations did you have with him about the recitation of the piece? Did you sort of guide him or coach him at all?
We walked down the street from our little studio to a recording studio at the end of Poinsettia. It's a recording studio where actually Michael Jackson, he recorded Thriller. And Kobe was so nervous to go in there. Like this, I mean, he's such a fan of Michael Jackson's work. Mm. And when we came time to record, Kobe was very quiet. He delivered it in a very simple, straightforward, conversational way. I thought, okay, good. Well, he's got that done. Now he's going to deliver something more dramatic. Second time, exactly the same. Third time, delivered it exactly the same. And at that point, I realized this is it. Kobe is going to deliver something very pure, entirely sincere, not inflected, not dramatized. He is not performing. He's revealing who he is. And it became the driver for the way every part of this whole piece was going to be.
I am wondering if he was thinking in terms of creating something that would speak for itself after he was gone, not only from the basketball court, but from from life? And was he thinking about his legacy and future generations and how they viewed him?
For Kobe, he knew what he had done in setting a path for others. So this was his purpose, very much to inspire new generations beyond him. I mean, that was very intentional. Talking to Kobe, he would have this intense, fierce look in his eyes that would... his spirit in this movie, it had to connect to you in a very visceral way, like him. And I told Kobe, I can't just animate you moving across and shooting the ball. I have to know what's in your head, what's in your heart. How are you feeling? And so we went shot by shot through YouTube of Kobe's 20 greatest plays, and he remembered every moment and described that moment, why he was able to do that shot, what was his intention. I could live in his skin. I mean, that's what was... For an animator, it's all about living in the skin of someone you animate. I mean, there was a... his fade shot where he would throw his right hip out a little bit, and left hip was just back just far enough. And then, you know, he would come at the opponent and then back off and leap up into the air at a certain angle and do the whole thing. And I studied it and I knew it. I knew it exactly, the angle of his hand. And so, early on I said, Kobe, you've got the worst basketball player in the world animating you. He said, that's okay, Glenn, because everything you learn about basketball is going to be through studying him. So after the film was done, we were at the Lakers training center and the lights were off on the court, and I walked in and grabbed a basketball. I thought, I can do this. I mean, and this was so much about Kobe. You just set your mind to it and you study and you can do it. So I got the ball and I went way back into a three-point shot. I mean, way back. I wasn't making it easy on myself. And I dribbled the ball and then I jumped and threw my right hip out and my hand. It was 90 degrees, everything, and all the way to releasing the ball. And Kobe would say, you know, even after the ball was off of his fingertips, I felt like I still had enough control. Like if I pulled my finger back, it might just not bounce too hard on the backboard. I mean, it was like this mystical connection of between him and the ball. And I felt all of that. And as I released the ball, it was flying. I mean, I could not believe it, straight for the basket on a perfect arc. I mean, I was dumbfounded. And then it fell 10 feet short. But...
How do you read the words now in the aftermath of this tragedy?
There's a profound depth to them about him talking about his body not being able to go on. It's time to give it up, time to let it go.
I did everything for you. Because that's what you do when someone makes you feel as alive as you've made me feel. You gave a six-year-old boy his Laker dream. And I'll always love you for it.
There was a moment where we had animated him walking into the tunnel, and it was first animated with him walking into the dark. And we felt that, this isn't right. He's not going away. So we changed it to walking into the light, into something new, into another purpose beyond. And it was very clear at that point for me that this was about a legacy that went far beyond Kobe. And it became very clear to me this was about after Kobe is gone, this legacy will continue on and touch many, many people. So there was inherent in that something that was that was really lasting.
Glenn Keane is a veteran animator and the director of the 2017 Oscar-winning animated short Dear Basketball, featuring the words and the voice of the late Kobe Bryant. Mr. Keane, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Love you always, Kobe.
Dear Basketball can be seen on Vimeo. And today comes news of a special tribute to Kobe Bryant planned for the Academy Awards on February 9th. Up next on The Frame, John Horne's Sundance Festival interview with filmmaker Carlos Lopez Estrada, who collaborated with 25 spoken word artists for his film called Summertime.
KPCC podcasts are supported by 20th Century Fox, presenting Ford vs. Ferrari, directed by James Mangold and starring Matt Damon and Christian Bale. Ford vs. Ferrari was named Best Film of the Year by Kenneth Turan of the Los Angeles Times, and now nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers. You're listening to the Oscar-nominated score from Joker, Todd Phillips' Oscar-nominated vision of a man struggling in a world without empathy. Variety's Owen Gleiberman named Joker the best film of 2019, calling it a movie that can and will stand the test of time. Joaquin Phoenix mesmerizes in the performance of the year, now nominated for 11 Academy Awards and 11 BAFTA Awards, including Best Picture, director Todd Phillips, and actor Joaquin Phoenix.
Yesterday at the Sundance Film Festival, John Horne spoke with the creators of a film driven by poetry. It's called Summertime and was directed by Carlos Lopez Estrada, who also made the film Blindspotting. Rather than use trained professional actors, Summertime stars spoken word artists, graffiti taggers, fast food workers, and limo drivers to tell a unique story about Los Angeles. John spoke with Estrada and two of the film's subjects, Markeisha Babers and Mila Kuda. Estrada began by describing the event that inspired him to make the film.
It was about 30 poets performing one after the other. They essentially would come on, introduce themselves, talk very briefly about sort of like their background, where they come from, and then perform a short piece. And we're walking out of that place just feeling so inspired, so moved. And I got to see a young group of artists talk so eloquently, so beautifully, so creatively about their experiences in their city, with their families, at home, them as individuals, things that were important to them. But we had this hunch that there was something there that was worth exploring and that these stories deserved a larger stage and a larger audience. So that's how it all began.
When you introduced the film at its first screening at Sundance, you said that you had this idea and you're making the film. And at a certain point, you say to yourself, what am I doing? Is this working? Because what you're doing is taking poetry and putting it into a prose story in a way where there's characters and narrative.
The entire process until maybe 5 or 6 days ago was a big existential crisis, just because by definition, this project is an experiment. From its very conception, the idea was to give them control, to let them lead the conversation, to tell us what they wanted the movie to be, as opposed to us telling them. The ultimate place where you could be as a director is to have total control, to have perfect understanding, perfect vision, and a group of people that support it and help you get exactly to where you want to get. And this was opposite. This was from the beginning saying, you know what, I'm going to take 10 steps back and let a bunch of people that I trust, but I don't really know, to tell me what the movie should be. And I cannot imagine a different way that this movie could have happened.
It's hard to describe common themes in all of the poems that are incorporated in the story, but I'm going to try one. And that is, you all are talking about how you're seen and how you want to be seen. So whoever wants to go first and share however much of your poem you want to share.
Yes, I'm just going to go into it. Hey, I'm gay and not up for debate. I'm gay, lesbian, Libra, lascivious, licentious. I'm gay as a wool flannel on a summer day. I'm so gay. In third grade, my best friend and I would sneak kisses peck for peck at the playground.
Just diving into the idea of what the movie is, I think the common thread of what you're talking about, like being seen, how you're seen, what
Carlos is saying is that I think at its core, this movie is about asking young people, youth poets, what they would like to see if their voices were not cut off, but instead amplified or uplifted. And it has a surreal aspect to it because there's a safety in that. There's a safety in imagining, because you're not being asked to situate yourself in reality. You're asking yourself to situate yourself in a world in which there can be subtle surrealism or, you know, more extravagant surrealism. So what I want to be perceived as is someone that does stand up for herself, right? And I do that in a lot of ways, but I don't always do that necessarily on the bus with a stranger, right? Like I'm not always safe enough to speak back at a homophobic person. And so I think that like perception and you know, being perceived is a really big part of that and the safety that comes with that.
People only see me as that girl. That fat girl, just a little too black girl, always sitting in the back girl, that girl. People tell me, you're weak girl. No one wants to hear you speak, girl. Look at me. I'm not at your feet, girl. Stop crying, girl. It's not like you're dying, girl. No one will like you for who you are. And your career definitely won't go far. Not with that hair, those clothes, those shoes. You really need to change all of you, girl. Sometimes I tell myself, you know, depression ain't cute, girl. And you stop waiting. So, yeah, that girl is actually a poem I wrote a long time ago when I was like 15. And it actually was like a really depressing poem. I was going through a lot. And it was like, I wrote it in like parts. Like, and it was like really just like about everything that I was going through. And then my poetry teacher was like, spruce it up a little bit, like, you know, make it a happy ending. And so I did, but I still wasn't happy just because I wrote the happy ending. And so, yeah, so now, like, I've been performing it here at Sundance for the past couple of days, and it's the first time that I've actually believed the happy ending. So it's really amazing.
We're talking with Markeisha Babers, Mila Kuta, and Carlos Lopez Estrada about their film Summertime. So these poets give you their lives and their language. So how do you go about applying story structure to what they've given you? And what were the biggest obstacles in terms of making it feel connected with so many disparate parts?
The tone of the movie was already established when I saw this poetry showcase, that the diversity of the people that we were following, the diversity of their stories, they were telling us where the movie was going to go. They were telling us how the movie was going to feel. And what we had to do was simply just give them the tools to tell their stories and to tell the truth in the way that they felt most excited and most inspired about. So it wasn't so much about crafting a movie out of their poetry or like making them fit into a three-act structure or making sure that you know the movie would make sense and would be sort of like critic proof. This was really just about taking a step back and saying, guys, I trust what you're saying. I believe that your words are powerful. And all that I'm going to give you is our crew, myself, and every tool that we can to make sure that you feel like what is important to you right now is being communicated in the loudest possible way. This was a community exercise in storytelling, and that they have as much ownership over this movie as anyone else.
I think that's a really important word, because when you are performing, you're generally up on stage alone. You're speaking for yourself, about yourself. But this is a movie about community and about how these people's stories intersect and how they come together. So are you giving up part of that to gain this other thing, to take on these other people with your story? How do you feel about giving up the fact that this is no longer mine, it's ours?
I actually think that it enhances it to another level in a good way, because like when I'm on stage alone, it's not necessarily for me most of the time. It's for other people. You know what I mean? It's for to help someone out of the rut that I was just in or that I'm still in. And when I did the film and we shot and it became this community thing, it was like, it was for us. It was uplifting us and each other and giving us the opportunity to actually finally use our poems to confront the situation head on. It just enhanced that feeling of like, I'm finally doing this for me.
when you're on an open mic, the imagery is strictly in your words and strictly in what the audience is imagining. But when you can control the literal imagery that you're projecting onto a screen, you are gaining so much in that. And you can show so much with that, even when you can't communicate it in words. And so I think that there's a really interesting sort of symbiotic relationship there that's happening in the editing process.
Arkesha, Miha, Carlos, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was director Carlos Lopez Estrada, along with poets Markeisha Babers and Mila Kudup, talking about their film, Summertime. Up next on The Frame, Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood has Oscar nominations in 10 categories, including production design. We'll tour the film's locations with its production designer.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers, presenting Joker, from Academy Award-nominated director, co-writer, and producer Todd Phillips. See Joaquin Phoenix's Golden Globe, Critics' Choice, and Screen Actors Guild winning performance. You're listening to the Oscar-nominated score. Variety's Owen Gleiberman named Joker the best film of 2019, calling it a movie that can and will stand the test of time. Now nominated for 11 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor, for your consideration.
Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood racked up 10 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture and Best Director. It's also nominated for the production design that recreated the heart of Hollywood from 50 years ago. To find out how the filmmakers pulled off the look, The Frame contributor Tim Grieving took a tour with the film's production designer Barbara Ling and location scout Richard Schuler.
I meet location manager Rick Schuler and production designer Barbara Ling at a very 2019 Starbucks on the corner of Sunset and Gower. We all hop in a car together, and they take me on a trip through Hollywood back in time.
Hollywood is a destination now, and we wanted to create more than that. It's like you get here and you go, well, where is Hollywood? Well, it's kind of an idea. And this movie was making it a place more so than anything else has done before.
Right now, in front of what is now the Aquarius Theater, rebirthed on Sunset Boulevard, we recreated at least one section of the building. This is where Hair premiered in the 60s. We had painters doing this, and they told me, they said, you know, this has to be the most fun project because people stop all day long and just scream up to them, thank you for putting it back.
We drive down Sunset and stop in front of the famous Cinerama Dome.
Barbara, were you surprised at how any of these places retained their 50-year-old characteristics, or was it a huge to-do to turn back time?
It was a huge to-do to turn back time. It's unfortunate that in L.A. we tear down as much as and as fast as we can of any of the old iconic pieces. The few that we have left, like the Cinerama Dome, the very facade, the marquee is still the original, and the golf ball top. But of course, in that time frame, there was nothing but parking lots on either side of it. So you have, you know, we did the premiere of Krakatoa here, but you could only shoot tight in because you had, of course, this whole world around it now that looks nothing like the 60s, but at least there's a little piece of something left. But that was rare.
Now we're in the touristy heart of Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard, tempted to go inside a famous restaurant for a midday martini.
Musso and Frank's featured in a big way in the movie. We repainted and did all kinds of things there. The nice thing about that restaurant is that they've preserved pretty much the integrity of everything that's there, from the leather and the booths to all of that kind of stuff. So that was a wonderful gem to find. What's to the left of it, however, the Cabo Cantina, all of that got stripped off, from the straw awning to all the signage and everything. And the Vogue Theater used to extend in front of that. So we put the Vogue Theater back in right there. And then over here, or in front of Barbara, at this hologram place here, which used to be the Pussycat Theater. And we turned that back to the Pussycat, put the whole facade back on there. People were like, whoa, what is this?
Shutting down Hollywood Boulevard for 2 days wasn't an easy feat. To convince the city officials and business owners, Rick Shuler knew he'd need to bring in a big gun, Quentin Tarantino.
He goes, well, Rick, do you think you can get Hollywood Boulevard, like shut down 9 blocks for 2 days in a row? And I'm thinking, I think I can get there 70% of the way, but I think if you come and speak to your enthusiasm about having grown up in Hollywood, owning a theater in Hollywood, doing a movie about Hollywood, that'll probably be a tipping point. And so he was willing to come. And then they had us leave the room, and a minute later I walked back in, and it was a unanimous vote. They were like, if he's going to show up, you know, we'll do it.
Tarantino not only grew up in Los Angeles, he now owns the historic Revival movie theater at the New Beverly, which came in handy when prepping Shuler and Ling for this film.
He'd invite us to his theater, and he'd show us movies from the 70s. And I forget the name, and maybe Barbara can remember that one Don Sutherland movie where it was total carnage on Hollywood Boulevard.
In this trailer for the 1970 film Alex in Wonderland, Sutherland plays a hippie film director who's perched in a crane above a very smoggy Hollywood Boulevard. In front of the Musso and Frank sign and the old Vogue marquee, bombs are exploding, soldiers are spraying machine guns everywhere, and men in tuxedos are dancing on top of a flaming car.
Donald Sutherland is Alex, and Wonderland is Hollywood.
I got a picture of that and took that to my meeting and said, okay, here's what you've done before, and I promise we won't do this kind of carnage.
Where are we now?
So we're El Coyote, which has a lot of pieces left of the original facade, and it's extremely iconic place in the 60s. So it was a must for Quentin, who, you know, who I might add still loves going to, you know, he still, you know, Musso's gave us the longest shutdown of anyone ever trying, because he actually, in everyday life, loves going to Musso's. So they're, you know, he's a customer that they know well.
Is there any attempt to preserve anything historic in Hollywood?
You know, I don't even know if there's a preservation board anymore.
There's an LA Conservancy that tries to. There are individuals that very much try to, but there's not a strong force that really does much of that.
Which means, if you want to see what Hollywood looked like 50 years ago, you're going to have to do it at the movies. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
That's all for today. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.